in her closet, but she was delirious then. She told me it was a coyote. So, do you know what's going on here? Can you tell me anything I need to know to treat the girl?
I can't, Walt said. But Mr. Johnson here knows the whole situation.
Thanks a lot, Lem said. Walt just smiled.
To Selbach, Lem said, I'm sorry, doctor, but I'm not at liberty to discuss the case. Anyway, nothing I could tell you would alter the treatment you'd give Tracy Keeshan.
When Lem and Walt finally got into Tracy's hospital room, leaving Dr. Selbach in the corridor to time their visit, they found a pretty 13-year-old who was badly bruised and as pale as snow. She was in bed, the sheets pulled up to her shoulders. Though she'd been given painkillers, she was alert, even edgy, and it was obvious why Selbach wanted to give her a sedative. She was trying not to show it, but she was scared.
I wish you'd leave, Lem told Walt Gaines. If wishes were filet mignon, we'd always eat well at dinner, Walt said.
Hi, Tracy. I'm Sheriff Walt Gaines, and this is Lemuel Johnson. I'm about as nice as they come, though Lem here is a real stinker. Everybody says so. But you don't have to worry because I'll keep him in line and make him be nice to you. Okay?
Together, they coaxed Tracy into a conversation. They quickly discovered that she'd told Selbach she'd been attacked by a coyote, because though she knew it wasn't true, she didn't believe she could convince the physician, or anyone else, of the truth of what she'd seen.
I was afraid they'd think I'd been hit real hard in the head. I had my brain scrambled, she said, and then they'd keep me here a lot longer.
Sitting on the edge of the girl's bed, Lem said, Tracy, you don't have to worry that I'll think you scrambled. I believe I know what you saw, and all I want from you is confirmation. She stared at him disbelievingly. Walt stood at the foot of her bed, smiling down at her, as if he were a big, affectionate teddy bear come to life. He said, Before you passed out, you told your dad you'd been attacked by the boogeyman who used to live in your closet.
It was sure ugly enough, the girl said quietly. But that's not what it was, I guess.
Tell me, Lem said. She stared at Walt, at Lem, then sighed.
You tell me what you think I should have seen, and if you're close, I'll tell you what I can remember. But I'm not going to start it, because I know you think I'm Looney Tunes.
Lem regarded Walt with unconcealed frustration, realizing there was no way to avoid divulging some of the facts of the case. Walt grinned. To the girl, Lem said,
Yellow eyes.
She gasped and went rigid.
Yes! You do know, don't you? You know what was out there.
She started to sit up, winced in pain as she pulled the stitches in her wound and slumped back against the bed.
What was it? What was it?
Tracy, Lem said. I can't tell you what it was. I've signed a secrecy oath. If I violated it, I could be put in jail. But more important, I wouldn't have much respect for myself.
She frowned, finally nodded.
I guess I can understand that.
Good. Now tell me everything you can about your assailant.
As it turned out, she had not seen much because the night was dark and her flashlight had illuminated the outsider for only an instant.
Pretty big for an animal. Maybe as big as me. The yellow eyes.
She shuddered.
And its face was strange.
In what way?
Lumpy. Deformed, the girl said.
Though she had been very pale at the start, she grew paler now, and fine beads of sweat appeared along her hairline, dampening her brow. Walt was leaning on the footrail of the bed, straining forward, intensely interested, not wanting to miss a word. A sudden Santa Ana wind buffeted the building, startling the girl. She looked fearfully at the rattling window, where the wind moaned, as if she was afraid something would come smashing through the glass, which was, Lem reminded himself, exactly how the outsider had gotten to West Dahlberg. The girl swallowed hard.
Its mouth was huge, and the teeth...
She could not stop shaking, and Lem put a reassuring hand on her shoulder.
It's okay, honey. It's over now. It's all behind you.
After a pause to regain control of herself, but still shivering, Tracy said,
I think it was kind of hairy or furry. I'm not sure, but it was very strong.
What kind of animal did it resemble? Lem asked.
She shook her head.
It wasn't like anything else.
But if you had to say it was like some other animal, would you say it was more like a cougar than anything else?
No, not a cougar.
Like a dog? She hesitated.
Maybe a little bit like a dog.
Maybe a little bit like a bear, too?
No.
Like a panther?
No, not like any cat.
Like a monkey?
She hesitated again, frowned, thinking,
I don't know why, but yeah, maybe a little like a monkey. Except no dog and no monkey has teeth like that.
The door opened from the hall, and Dr. Selbach appeared.
You're already past 5 minutes.
Walt started to wave the doctor out.
Lem said, No, it's okay, we're finished. Half a minute yet.
I'm counting the seconds,
Selbach said, retreating.
To the girl, Lem said, Can I rely on you?
She matched his gaze and said,
To keep quiet?
Lem nodded.
She said, Yeah, I sure don't want to tell anybody. My folks think I'm mature for my age, mentally and emotionally mature, I mean. But if I start telling wild stories about monsters, they're going to think I'm not so mature after all, and maybe they'll figure I'm not responsible enough to take care of the horses, and so maybe they'll slow down the breeding plans. I won't risk that, Mr. Johnson. No, sir. So as far as I'm concerned, it was a local coyote. But...
Yes?
Can you tell me, is there any chance it'll come back?
I don't think so. But it would be wise for a while not to go out to the stable at night, all right?
All right, she said.
Judging by her haunted expression, she would remain indoors after dusk for weeks to come. They left the room, thanked Dr. Selbach for his cooperation, and went down to the hospital's parking garage. Dawn had not yet arrived, and the cavernous concrete structure was empty, desolate. Their footsteps echoed hollowly off the walls. Their cars were on the same floor, and Walt accompanied Lem to the green, unmarked NSA sedan. As Lem put the key in the door to unlock it, Walt looked around to be sure they were alone, then said,
Tell me. Can't. I'll find out. You're off the case. So take me to court, get a bench warrant. I might. For endangering the national security. It'd be a fair charge. Throw my ass in jail. I might, Lem said, though he knew he would not.
Curiously, though Walt's doggedness was frustrating and more than a little irritating, it was also pleasing to Lem. He had few friends, of which Walt was the most important, and he liked to think the reason he had few friends was because he was selective, with high standards. If Walt had backed off entirely, if he had been completely cowed by federal authority, if he'd been unable to turn off his curiosity as easily as turning off a light switch, he would have been slightly tarnished and diminished in Lem's eyes.
What reminds you of a dog and an ape and has yellow eyes? Walt asked. Aside from your mama, that is. You leave my mama out of this, honky, Lem said.
Smiling in spite of himself, he got into the car. Walt held the door open and leaned down to look in at him.
What in the name of God escaped from Bannadyne? I told you this has nothing to do with Bannadyne. And the fire they had at the labs the next day. Did they set it themselves to destroy the evidence of what they'd been up to? Don't be ridiculous, Lem said wearily, thrusting the key into the ignition. Evidence could be destroyed in a more efficient and less drastic manner, if there was evidence to destroy, which there isn't, because Bannadyne has nothing to do with this.
Lem started the car, but Walt would not give up. He held the door open and leaned in even closer to be heard above the rumble of the engine.
Genetic engineering. That's what they're involved with at Bannadyne, tinkering with bacteria and virus to make new bugs that do good deeds like manufacture insulin or eat oil slicks. And they tinker with the genes of plants as well, I guess, to produce corn that grows in acidic soil or wheat that thrives with half the usual watering. We always think of gene tinkering as being done on a small scale, plants and germs. But they could screw around with an animal's genes, so it produced bizarre offspring, a whole new species. Is that what they've done? And is that what's escaped from Bannadyne?
Lem shook his head exasperatedly.
Walt, I'm not an expert on recombinant DNA, but I don't think the science is nearly sophisticated enough to work with any degree of confidence on that sort of thing.
And what would be the point, anyway?
Okay, just supposing they could make a weird new animal by fiddling with the genetic structure of an existing species. What use would there be for it? I mean, aside from exhibition in a carnival freak show.
Walt's eyes narrowed.
I don't know. You tell me.
Listen, research money is always damn tight, and there's fierce competition for every major and minor grant, so no one's going to be able to afford to experiment with something that has no use. Get me?
Now, because I'm involved here, you know this has to be a matter of national defense, which would mean Bannadyne was squandering Pentagon money to make a carnival freak.
The words squander and Pentagon have sometimes been used in the same sentence, Walt said dryly.
Be real, Walt. It's one thing for the Pentagon to let some of its contractors waste money in the production of a needed weapon system, but it's altogether another thing for them to knowingly hand out funds for experiments with no defense potential. The system is sometimes inefficient, sometimes even corrupt, but it's never outright stupid.
Anyway, I'll say it one more time. This entire conversation is pointless, because this has nothing to do with Bannadyne.
Walt stared in at him for a long moment, then sighed.
Jesus, Lem. You're good. I know you've got to be lying to me, but I half think you're telling the truth.
I am telling the truth.
You're good.
So tell me, what about Weatherby, Yarbeck, and the others? Got their killer yet?
No. In fact, the man Lem had put in charge of the case had reported that it appeared as if the Soviets had used a killer outside of their own agencies, and perhaps outside of the political world entirely. The investigation seemed stymied. But all he said to Walt was, no.
Walt started to straighten up and close the car door, then leaned down and in again.
One more thing. You notice it seems to have a meaningful destination?
What are you talking about?
It's been moving steadily north or north-northwest ever since it broke out of Bannadyne, Walt said.
It didn't break out of Bannadyne, damn it!
From Bannadyne to Holy Jim Canyon, from there to Irvine Park, and from there to the Keeshan House tonight. Steadily north or northwest. I suppose you know what that might mean, where it might be headed. But of course I daren't ask you about it, or you'll heave me straight into prison and let me rot there. I'm telling you the truth about Bannadyne.
So you say.
You're impossible, Walt.
So you say.
So everyone says.
Now will you let me go home? I'm beat.
Smiling, Walt closed the door at last. Lem drove out of the hospital garage to Main Street, then to the freeway, heading home toward Placentia. He hoped to make it back into bed no later than dawn. As he piloted the NSA sedan through streets as empty as mid-ocean sea lanes, he thought about the outsider heading northward. He'd noticed the same thing himself, and he was convinced that he knew what it was seeking, even if he did not know where precisely it was going. From the first, the dog and the outsider had possessed a special awareness of each other, an uncanny instinctual awareness of each other's moods and activities, even when they were not in the same room. Davis Weatherby had suggested, more than half seriously, that there was something telepathic about the relationship of those two creatures. Now the outsider was very likely still in tune with the dog, and by some sixth sense, was following it. For the dog's sake, Lem hoped to God that was not the case. It had been evident in the lab that the dog had always feared the outsider, and with good reason. The two were the yin and yang of the Francis Project, the success and the failure, the good and the bad. As wonderful, right, and good as the dog was, well, the outsider was every bit as hideous, wrong, and evil. And the researchers had seen that the outsider did not fear the dog, but hated it, with a passion that no one had been able to understand. Now that both were free, the outsider might single-mindedly pursue the dog, for it had never wanted anything more than to tear the retriever limb from limb. Lem realized that, in his anxiety, he had put his foot down too hard on the accelerator. The car was rocketing along the freeway. He eased back on the pedal. Wherever the dog was, with whomever it had found shelter, it was in jeopardy. And those who had given it shelter were also in grave danger.
Chapter 6 Part 1 Through the last week of May and the first week of June, Nora and Travis and Einstein were together nearly every day. Initially, she had worried that Travis was somehow dangerous, not as dangerous as Art Streck, but still to be feared. However, she'd soon gotten through that spell of paranoia. Now she laughed at herself when she remembered how wary of him she'd been. He was sweet and kind, precisely the sort of man who, according to her Aunt Violet, did not exist anywhere in the world. Once Nora's paranoia had been overcome, she'd then been convinced that the only reason Travis continued to see her was because he pitied her. Being the compassionate man he was, he would not be able to turn his back on anyone in desperate need or trouble. Most people meeting Nora would not think of her as desperate, perhaps strange and shy and pathetic, but not desperate. Yet she was, or had been, desperately unable to cope with the world beyond her own four walls, desperately afraid of the future, and desperately lonely. Travis, being every bit as perceptive as he was kind, saw her desperation and responded to it. Gradually, as May faded into June, and the days grew hotter under the summer sun, she dared to consider the possibility that he was helping her not because he pitied her, but because he really liked her. But she couldn't understand what a man like him would see in a woman like her. She seemed to have nothing whatsoever to offer. All right, yes, she had a self-image problem. Maybe she was not really as hopelessly drab and dull as she felt. Still, Travis clearly deserved, and could surely have, better female companionship than she could provide. She decided not to question his interest. The thing to do was just relax and enjoy it. Because Travis had sold his real estate business after the death of his wife and was essentially retired, and because Nora had no job either, they were free to be together most of the day if they wanted. And they were. They went to galleries, haunted bookstores, took long walks, went on longer drives into the picturesque Santa Ynez Valley or up along the gorgeous Pacific coast. Twice they set out early in the morning for Los Angeles and spent a long day there. And Nora was as overwhelmed by the sheer size of the city as she was by the activities they pursued. A movie studio tour, a visit to the zoo, and a matinee performance of a hit musical. One day, Travis talked her into having her hair cut and styled. He took her to a beauty parlor that his late wife had frequented, and Nora was so nervous that she stuttered when she spoke to the beautician, a perky blonde named Melanie. Violet always cut Nora's hair at home, and after Violet's death, Nora cut it herself. Being tended by a beautician was a new experience, as unnerving as eating in a restaurant for the first time. Melanie did something she called feathering, and cut off a lot of Nora's hair while somehow still leaving it full. They did not allow Nora to watch in the mirror, did not let her get a glimpse of herself until she was blown dry and combed out. Then they spun her around in the chair and confronted her with herself. And when she saw her reflection, she was stunned. "You look terrific," Travis said. "It's a total transformation," Melanie said. "Terrific," Travis said. "You've got such a pretty face, great bone structure," Melanie said. "But all that straight, long hair made your features look elongated and pointy. This frames your face to its best advantage." Even Einstein seemed to like the change in her. When they left the beauty shop, the dog was waiting for them where they had left him tethered to a parking meter. He did a canine double take when he saw Nora, jumped up with his front paws on her, and sniffed her face and hair, whining happily and wagging his tail. She hated the new look. When they had turned her to the mirror, she'd seen a pathetic old maid trying to pass for a pretty, vivacious young thing. The styled hair was simply not her. It only emphasized that she was basically a plain, drab woman. She would never be sexy, charming, with it, or any of the other things that the new hairstyle tried to say she was. It was rather like fastening a brightly colored feather duster to the back end of a turkey and attempting to pass it off as a peacock. Because she did not want to hurt Travis's feelings, she pretended to like what had been done to her. But that night she washed her hair and brushed it dry, pulling on it until all the so-called style had been tugged from it. Because of the feathering, it did not hang as straight and lank as it had previously, but she did the best with it that she could. The next day, when Travis picked her up for lunch, he was clearly startled to find that she had reverted to her previous look. However, he said nothing about it, asked no questions. She was so embarrassed and afraid of having hurt his feelings that for the first couple of hours she was not able to meet his eyes for more than a second or two at a time. In spite of her repeated and increasingly vigorous demurals, Travis insisted on taking her shopping for a new dress, a bright and summery frock that she could wear to dinner at Talk of the Town, a dressy restaurant on West Gutierrez, where he said you could sometimes see some of the movie stars who lived in the area, members of a film colony second only to that in Beverly Hills, Bel Air. They went to an expensive store, where she tried on a score of dresses, modeling each for Travis's reaction, blushing and mortified. The saleswoman seemed genuinely approving of the way everything looked on Nora, and she kept telling Nora that her figure was perfect. But Nora couldn't shake the feeling that the woman was laughing at her. The dress Travis liked best was from the Diane Fries collection. Nora couldn't deny that it was lovely, predominantly red and gold, but with an almost riotous background of other colors somehow more right in combination than they should have been, which apparently was a trait of Fries's designs. It was exceedingly feminine. On a beautiful woman, it would have been a knockout, but it just was not her. Dark colors, shapeless cuts, simple fabrics, no ornamentation whatsoever, that was her style. She tried to tell him what was best for her, explained that she could never wear such a dress as this, but he said, "You look gorgeous in it, really, you look gorgeous." She let him buy it. Dear God, she really did. She knew it was a big mistake, was wrong, and that she would never wear it. As the dress was being wrapped, Nora wondered why she had acquiesced, and she realized that in spite of being mortified, she was flattered to have a man buying clothes for her, to have a man take an interest in her appearance. She never dreamed such a thing would happen to her, and she was overwhelmed. She couldn't stop blushing. Her heart pounded. She felt dizzy, but it was a good dizziness. Then, as they were leaving the store, she learned that he had paid $500 for the dress. $500! She had intended to hang it in the closet and look at it a lot, use it as a starting point for pleasant daydreams, which was all fine and dandy if it had cost $50. But for $500, she would have to wear it even if it made her feel ridiculous, even if she did look like a poseur, a scrub woman pretending to be a princess. The following evening, during the 2 hours before Travis was to pick her up and escort her to Talk of the Town, she put the dress on and took it off a half dozen times. She repeatedly sorted through the contents of her closet, searching frantically for something else to wear, something more sensible. But she didn't have anything, because she had never before needed clothes for a dressy restaurant. Scowling at herself in the bathroom mirror, she said, "You look like Dustin Hoffman in Tootsie." She suddenly laughed, because she knew she was being too hard on herself. But she couldn't go easier on herself, because that was how she felt, like a guy in drag. In this case, feelings were more important than facts, so her laughter quickly soured. She broke down and cried twice, and considered calling him to cancel their date. But she wanted more than anything to see him, no matter how horribly humiliating the evening was going to be. She used murine to get the red out of her eyes, and she tried the dress on again, and took it off. When he arrived at a few minutes past 7, he looked handsome in a dark suit. Nora was wearing a shapeless blue shift with dark blue shoes. He said, "I'll wait." She said, "Huh? For what?" "You know," he said, meaning, "Go change." The words came out in a nervous rush, and her excuse was limp. "Travis, I'm sorry. This is terrible. I'm so sorry, but I spilled coffee all over the dress." "I'll wait in here," he said, walking to the living room archway. She said, "A whole pot of coffee." "Better hurry. Our reservation is for 7:30. Steeling herself for the amused whispers, if not outright laughter, of everyone who saw her, telling herself that Travis's opinion was the only one that mattered, she changed into the Diane Fries dress. She wished she had not undone the hairstyle that Melanie had given her a couple of days ago. Maybe that would help. No, it would probably just make her look more ludicrous. When she came downstairs again, Travis smiled at her and said, "You're lovely." She didn't know whether the food at Talk of the Town was as good as its reputation or not. She tasted nothing. Later, she could not clearly remember the decor of the place either, though the faces of the other customers, including the actor Gene Hackman, were burned into her memory because she was certain that all evening they were staring at her with amazement and disdain. In the middle of dinner, evidently well aware of her discomfort, Travis put down his wine glass and leaned toward her and said quietly, "You really do look lovely, Nora, no matter what you think. And if you had the experience to be aware of such things, you'd realize that most of the men in the room are attracted to you." But she knew the truth, and she could face it. If men really were staring at her, it was not because she was pretty. People could be expected to stare at a turkey with a feather duster trying to pass itself off as a peacock. "Without a trace of makeup," he said, "you look better than any woman in the room." No makeup. That was another reason they were staring at her. When a woman put on a $500 dress to be taken to an expensive restaurant, she made herself look as good as possible with lipstick, eyeliner, makeup, skin blush, and God knew what else. But Nora had never even thought about makeup. The chocolate mousse dessert, though surely delicious, tasted like library paste to her and repeatedly stuck in her throat. She and Travis had talked for long hours during the past couple of weeks, and they'd found it surprisingly easy to reveal intimate feelings and thoughts to each other. She had learned why he was alone in spite of his good looks and relative wealth, and he had learned why she harbored a low opinion of herself. So when she could not choke down any more of the mousse, when she implored Travis to take her home right away, he said softly, "If there's any justice, Violet Devon is sweating in hell tonight." Shocked, Nora said, "Oh no, she wasn't that bad." All the way home, he was silent, brooding. When he left her at her door, he insisted she set up a meeting with Garrison Dilworth, who had been her aunt's attorney, and now took care of Nora's minor legal business. "From what you've told me," Travis said, "Dilworth knew your aunt better than anyone. So I'd bet dollars to donuts he can tell you things about her that will break this goddamn stranglehold she has on you even from the grave." Nora said, "But there are no great dark secrets about Aunt Violet. She was what she appeared to be. She was a very simple woman, really. A sort of sad woman." "Sad my ass," Travis said. He persisted until she agreed to make the appointment with Garrison Dilworth. Later, upstairs in her bedroom, when she tried to take off the Diane Freeze, she discovered she didn't want to undress. All evening she'd been impatient to get out of that costume, for it had seemed like a costume on her. But now, in retrospect, the evening possessed a warm glow, and she wanted to prolong that glow. Like a sentimental high school girl, she slept in the $500 dress. Garrison Dilworth's office had been carefully decorated to convey respectability, stability, and reliability. Beautifully detailed oak paneling, heavy royal blue drapes hung from brass rods, shelves full of leather-bound law books, a massive oak desk. The attorney himself was an intriguing cross between a personification of dignity and probity and Santa Claus. Tall, rather portly, with thick silver hair, past 70 but still working a full week, Garrison favored three-piece suits and subdued ties. In spite of his many years as a Californian, his deep and smooth and cultured voice clearly marked him as a product of the upper-class Eastern circles in which he had been born, raised, and educated. But there was also a decidedly merry twinkle in his eyes, and his smile was quick, warm, altogether Santa-like. He did not distance himself by staying behind his desk, but sat with Nora and Travis in comfortable armchairs around a coffee table on which stood a large Waterford bowl. "I don't know what you came here expecting to learn. There are no secrets about your aunt, no great dark revelations that will change your life."
"I knew as much," Nora said. "I'm sorry we've bothered you."
"Wait," Travis said.
"Let Mr. Dilworth finish."
The attorney said, "Violet Devon was my client, and an attorney has a responsibility to protect clients' confidences even after their death. At least, that's my view, though some in the profession might not feel such a lasting obligation. Of course, as I'm speaking to Violet's closest living relative and heir, I suppose there's little I would choose not to divulge, if in fact there were any secrets to reveal. And I certainly see no moral constraint against my expressing an honest opinion of your aunt.
Even attorneys, priests, and doctors are allowed to have opinions of people.
He took a deep breath and frowned.
I never liked her. I thought she was a narrow-minded, totally self-involved woman who was at least slightly, well, mentally unstable. And the way she raised you was criminal, Nora. Not abusive in any legal sense that would interest the authorities, but criminal nonetheless, and cruel.
For as long as Nora could recall, a large knot had seemed to be tied tight inside of her, pinching vital organs and vessels, leaving her tense, restricting the flow of blood, and making it necessary for her to live with all her senses damped down, forcing her to struggle along as if she were a machine getting insufficient power. Suddenly, Garrison Dilworth's words untied that knot, and a full, unrestricted current of life rushed through her for the first time. She had known what Violet Devon had done to her, but knowing was not enough to help her overcome that grim upbringing. She needed to hear her aunt condemned by someone else. Travis had already denounced Violet, and Nora had felt some small release at hearing what he said. But that had not been enough to free her because Travis hadn't known Violet, and therefore spoke without complete authority. Garrison knew Violet well, however, and his words released Nora from bondage. She was trembling violently, and tears were trickling down her face. But she was unaware of both conditions until Travis reached out from his chair to put one hand consolingly upon her shoulder. She fumbled in her purse for a handkerchief.
I'm sorry.
Dear lady, Garrison said, don't apologize for breaking through that iron shell you've been in all your life. This is the first time I've seen you show a strong emotion. The first time I've seen you in any condition other than extreme shyness, and it's lovely to behold. Turning to Travis, giving Nora time to blot her eyes, he said, What more did you hope to hear me say? There's some things Nora doesn't know. Things she ought to know. And that I don't believe would violate even your strict code of client privilege if you were to divulge them.
Such as? Travis said.
Violet Devon never worked, yet lived reasonably well, never in want, and she left enough funds to keep Nora pretty much for the rest of her life, at least as long as Nora stays in that house and lives like a recluse. Where did her money come from?
Come from? Garrison sounded surprised.
Nora knows that, surely.
But she doesn't, Travis said.
Nora looked up and saw Garrison Dilworth staring at her in astonishment. He blinked and said, Violet's husband was moderately well-to-do. He died quite young, and she inherited everything.
Nora gaped at him and could barely find sufficient breath to speak.
Husband?
George Olmsted, the attorney said.
I've never heard that name.
Garrison blinked rapidly again, as if sand had blown in his face.
She never mentioned a husband?
Never.
But didn't a neighbor ever mention?
We had nothing to do with our neighbors,
Nora said.
Violet didn't approve of them.
And in fact, Garrison said, now that I think about it, there might have been new neighbors on both sides by the time you came to live with Violet.
Nora blew her nose and put away her handkerchief. She was still trembling. Her sudden sense of release from bondage had generated powerful emotions, but now they subsided somewhat to make room for curiosity.
All right? Travis asked. She nodded, then stared hard at him and said,
You knew, didn't you? About the husband, I mean. That's why you brought me here.
I suspected, Travis said. If she'd inherited everything from her parents, she would have mentioned it. The fact that she didn't talk about where the money came from, well, it seemed to me to leave only one possibility, a husband, and very likely a husband with whom she'd had troubles, which made even more sense when you think about how down she was on people in general, and on men in particular.
The attorney was so dismayed and agitated that he could not sit still. He got up and paced past an enormous antique globe that was lighted from within and seemed made of parchment.
I'm flabbergasted. So you never really understood why she was bitterly misanthropic, why she suspected everyone of having her worst interests at heart?
No, Nora said. I didn't need to know why, I guess.
It was just the way she was.
Still pacing, Garrison said, Yes, that's true. I'm convinced she was a borderline paranoid even in her youth. And then when she discovered that George had betrayed her with other women, the switch clicked all the way over in her. She got much worse after that.
Travis said,
Why did Violet still use her maiden name, Devon, if she'd been married to Olmsted? She didn't want his name anymore, loathed the name. She sent him packing, very nearly drove him out of the house with a stick. She was about to divorce him when he died, Garrison said. She had learned about his affairs with other women, as I've said. She was furious, ashamed and enraged. I must say I can't entirely blame poor George, because I don't think he found much love and affection at home. He knew the marriage was a mistake within a month of the wedding.
Garrison paused beside the globe, one hand resting lightly on top of the world, staring far into the past. Ordinarily, he did not look his age. Now, as he gazed back across the years, the lines in his face seemed to deepen, and his blue eyes appeared faded. After a moment, he shook his head and continued.
Anyway, those were different times, when a woman betrayed by a husband was an object of pity, ridicule. But even for those days, I thought Violet's reaction was overblown. She burned all his clothes and changed the locks on the house. She even killed a dog, a spaniel, of which he was fond, poisoned it, and mailed it to him in a box.
Dear God, Travis said.
Garrison said, Violet took back her maiden name because she didn't want his anymore. The thought of carrying George Olmsted's name through life repelled her, she said, even though he was dead. She was an unforgiving woman.
Yes, Nora agreed. His face pinched with distaste at the memory, and Garrison said, When George was killed, she didn't bother to conceal her pleasure.
Killed? Nora half expected to hear that Violet had murdered George Olmsted, yet had somehow escaped prosecution.
It was an auto accident 40 years ago, Garrison said. He lost control on the coast highway driving home from Los Angeles, went over the edge, where in those days there wasn't a guardrail. The embankment was 60 or 80 feet high, very steep, and George's car, a large black Packard, rolled over several times on the way down to the rocks below. Violet inherited everything, because though she had initiated divorce proceedings against him, George had not gotten around to changing his will.
Travis said, So George Olmsted not only betrayed Violet, but in dying, left her with no target for her anger.
So she directed that anger at the world in general.
And at me in particular, Nora said.
That same afternoon, Nora told Travis about her painting. She had not mentioned her artistic pursuits before, and he had not been in her bedroom to see her easel, supply cabinet, and drawing board. She was not sure why she had kept this aspect of her life a secret from him. She had mentioned an interest in art, which was why they had gone to galleries and museums, but perhaps she had never spoken of her own work because she was afraid that, on seeing her canvases, he would be unimpressed. What if he felt that she had no real talent? Aside from the escape provided by books, the thing that kept Nora going through many grim, lonely years was her painting. She believed that she was good, perhaps very good, though she was too shy and too vulnerable to voice that conviction to anyone. What if she was wrong? What if she had no talent and had been merely filling time? Her art was the primary medium by which she defined herself. She had little else with which to sustain even her thin and shaky self-image, so she desperately needed to believe in her talent. Travis's opinion meant more to her than she could say, and if his reaction to her painting was negative, she would be devastated. But after leaving Garrison Dilworth's office, Nora knew that the time had come to take the risk. The truth about Violet Devon had been a key that had unlocked Nora's emotional prison. She would need a long time to move from her cell, down the long hall to the outside world, but the journey would inevitably continue. Therefore, she would have to open herself to all the experiences that her new life provided, including the awful possibility of rejection and severe disappointment. Without risk, there was no hope of gain. Back at the house, she considered taking Travis upstairs to have a look at a half dozen of her most recent paintings. But the idea of having a man in her bedroom, even with the most innocent intentions, was too unsettling. Garrison Dilworth's revelations freed her, yes, and her world was rapidly broadening, but she was not yet that free. Instead, she insisted that Travis and Einstein sit on one of the big sofas in the furniture-stuffed living room, where she would bring some of her canvases for viewing. She turned on all the lights, drew the drapes away from the windows, and said, "I'll be right back." But upstairs she dithered over the 10 paintings in her bedroom, unable to decide which two she should take to him first. Finally, she settled on 4 pieces, though it was a bit awkward carrying that many at once. Halfway down the stairs, she halted, trembling, and decided to take the paintings back and select others. But she retreated only 4 steps before she realized that she could spend the entire day in vacillation. Reminding herself that nothing could be gained without risk, she took a deep breath and went quickly downstairs with the 4 paintings that she had originally chosen. Travis liked them. More than liked them. He raved about them. "My God, Nora, this is no hobby painting. This is the real thing. This is art." She propped the paintings on 4 chairs, and he was not content to study them from the sofa. He got up for a closer look, moved from one canvas to another and back again. "You're a superb photorealist," he said. "Okay, so I'm no art critic, but by God, you're as skilled as Wyeth. But this other thing, this eerie quality in 2 of these..." His compliments had left her blushing furiously, and she had to swallow hard to find her voice. "A touch of surrealism." She had brought 2 landscapes and 2 still lives. One of each was indeed strictly a photorealist work. But the other 2 were photorealism with a strong element of surrealism. In the still life, for example, several water glasses, a pitcher, spoons, and a sliced lemon were on a table, portrayed in excruciating detail. And at first glance, the scene looked very realistic. But at second glance, you noticed that one of the glasses was melting into the surface on which it stood, and that one slice of lemon was penetrating the side of a glass, as if the glass had been formed around it. "They're brilliant. They really are," he said. "Do you have others?" Did she have others? She made 2 additional trips to her bedroom, returning with 6 more paintings. With each new canvas, Travis's excitement grew. His delight and enthusiasm were genuine, too. Initially, she thought that he might be humoring her, but soon she was certain he was not disguising his true reaction. Moving from canvas to canvas and back again, he said, "Your sense of color is excellent." Einstein accompanied Travis around the room, adding a soft woof after each of his master's statements and vigorously wagging his tail, as if expressing agreement with the assessment. "There's such mood in these pieces," Travis said. "Woof! Your control of the medium is astonishing. I've no sense that I'm looking at thousands of brush strokes. Instead, it seems as if the picture just appeared on the canvas magically. Woof! It's hard to believe you've had no formal schooling. Woof! Nora, these are easily good enough to sell. Any gallery would take these in a minute. Woof! You could not only make a living at this, I think you could build one hell of a reputation." Because she had not dared to admit how seriously she had always taken her work, Nora had often painted one picture over another, using a canvas again and again. As a consequence, many of her pieces were gone forever. But in the attic, she had stored more than 80 of her best paintings. Now, because Travis insisted, they brought down more than 40 of those wrapped canvases, tore off the brown paper, and propped them on the living room furniture. For the first time in Nora's memory, that dark chamber looked bright and welcoming. "Any gallery would be delighted to do a show of these," Travis said. "In fact, tomorrow, let's load some of them into the truck and take them around to a few galleries. Hear what they say."
"Oh, no, no.
I promise you, Nora, you won't be disappointed." She was suddenly in the clutches of anxiety. Although thrilled by the prospect of a career in art, she was also frightened by the big step she would be taking, like walking off the edge of a cliff. She said,
"Not yet. In a week, or a month, we'll load them in the truck and take them to a gallery. But not yet, Travis. I just can't. I can't handle it yet."
He grinned at her. "Sensory overload again?"
Einstein came to her and rubbed against her leg, looking up with a sweet expression that made Nora smile. Scratching behind the dog's ears, she said, "So much has happened so fast. I can't absorb it all. I keep having to fight off attacks of dizziness. I feel a little bit as if I'm on a carousel that's whirling around faster and faster, out of control." What she said was true to an extent, but that was not the only reason she wished to delay going public with her art. She also wanted to move slowly in order to have time to savor every glorious development. If she rushed into things, the transformation from reclusive spinster to a full-fledged participant in life would go too fast, and later it would be just a blur. She wanted to enjoy every moment of her metamorphosis. As if she were an invalid who had been confined since birth to a single dark room full of life support equipment, and as if she had just been miraculously cured, Nora Devon was coming cautiously out into a new world. Travis was not solely responsible for Nora's emergence from reclusion. Einstein had an equally large role in her transformation. The retriever had obviously decided that Nora could be trusted with the secret of his extraordinary intelligence. After the modern bride and baby business in solving, the dog gave her glimpse after glimpse of his undog-like mind at work. Taking his lead from Einstein, Travis told Nora how he had found the retriever in the woods and how something strange and never seen had been pursuing it. He recounted all the amazing things the dog had done since then. He also told her of Einstein's occasional bouts of anxiety in the heart of the night, when he sometimes stood at a window and stared out at the darkness as if he believed the unknown creature in the woods would find him. They sat for hours one evening in Nora's kitchen, drinking pots of coffee and eating homemade pineapple cake and discussing explanation for the dog's uncanny intelligence. When not catching bits of cake, Einstein listened to them with interest, as if he understood what they were saying about him. And sometimes he whined and paced impatiently, as if frustrated that his canine vocal apparatus did not permit him to speak. But they were mostly spinning their wheels because they had no explanations worth discussing. "I believe he could tell us where he comes from, why he's so damn different from other dogs," Nora said. Einstein busily swept the air with his tail. "Oh, I'm sure of it," Travis said. "He's got a human-like self-awareness. He knows he's different, and I suspect he knows why. And I think he'd like to tell us about it if he could only find a way." The retriever barked once, ran to the far end of the kitchen, ran back, looked up at them, did a frantic little dance of purely human frustration, and finally slumped on the floor with his head on his paws, alternately chuffing and whining softly. Nora was most intrigued by the story of the night that the dog had gotten excited over Travis's book collection. "He recognizes that books are a means of communication," she said. "And maybe he senses there's a way to use books to bridge the communications gap between him and us." "How?" Travis asked, as he lifted another forkful of pineapple cake. Nora shrugged. "I don't know, but maybe the problem was that your books weren't the right kind. Novels, you said?" "Yeah, fiction," she said. "Maybe what we need is books with pictures, images he can react to. Maybe if we gathered up a lot of picture books of all kinds, and magazines with pictures, and maybe if we spread them out on the floor and worked with Einstein, maybe we'd find some way to communicate with him." The retriever leaped to his feet and padded directly to Nora. From the expression on his face and from the intent look in his eyes, Nora knew that her proposal was a good one. Tomorrow she would collect dozens of books and magazines and put the scheme into operation. "It's going to take a lot of patience," Travis warned her. "I've got oceans of patience." "You may think you have, but sometimes dealing with Einstein gives a whole new meaning to the word." Turning to Travis, the dog blew air out of his nostrils. The prospects for more direct communication looked bleak during the first few sessions with the dog on Wednesday and Thursday. But the big breakthrough was not long in coming. Friday evening, June 4th, they found the way. And after that, their lives could never be the same. Part 2. Reports of screaming in an unfinished housing tract, Bordeaux Ridge. Friday evening, June 4th, less than an hour before nightfall, the sun cast gold and copper light on Orange County. It was the second day of blistering temperatures in the mid-90s,
and the stored heat of the long summer day radiated off the pavement and buildings. Trees seemed to droop wearily. The air was motionless. On the freeways and surface streets, the sound of traffic was muffled, as if the thick air filtered the roar of engines and blaring of horns. "Repeat, Bordeaux Ridge, under construction at the east end." In the gently rolling foothills to the northeast, in an unincorporated area of the county adjacent to Yorba Linda, where the suburban sprawl had only recently begun to reach, there was little traffic. The occasional blast of a horn or squeal of brakes was not merely muffled, but curiously mournful, melancholy in the humid stillness. Sheriff's Deputy Teal Porter and Ken Dimes were in a patrol car, Teal driving, Ken riding shotgun, with a broken ventilation system, no air conditioning, not even forced air coming out of the vents. The windows were open, but the sedan was an oven.
"You stink like a dead hog," Teal Porter told his partner.
"Yeah," Ken Dimes said.
"Well, you not only stink like a dead hog, you look like a dead hog."
"Yeah, well, you date dead hogs."
Ken smiled in spite of the heat.
"That's so. Well, I hear from your women that you make love like a dead hog."
Their tired humor could not mask the fact that they were weary and uncomfortable. And they were answering a call that didn't promise much excitement. Probably kids playing games. Kids love to play on construction sites. Both deputies were 32, husky former high school football players. They weren't brothers, but as partners for 6 years, they were brothers. Teal turned off the county road onto a lightly oiled dirt lane that led into the Bordeaux Ridge development. About 40 houses were in various stages of construction. Most were still being framed, but a few had already been stuccoed.
"Now there," Ken said, "is the kind of shit I just can't believe people fall for. I mean, hell, what kind of name is Bordeaux for a housing tract in Southern California? They trying to make you believe there's going to be vineyards here one day? And they call it Ridge, but the whole tract's in this stretch of flatland between the hills. Their sign promises serenity. Maybe now, but what about when they pitch up another 3,000 houses out here in the next 5 years?
Teal said,
"Yeah, but the part that gets me is mini estates. What the fuck is a mini estate? Nobody in his right mind would think these are estates, except maybe Russians who've spent their lives living 12 to an apartment. These are tract homes."
The concrete curbs and gutters had been poured along the streets of Bordeaux Ridge, but the pavement had not yet been put down. Teal drove slowly, trying not to raise a lot of dust, raising it anyway. He and Ken looked left and right at the skeletal forms of unfinished houses, searching for kids who were up to no good. To the west, at the edge of the city of Yorba Linda and adjacent to Bordeaux Ridge, were finished tracts where people already lived. From those residents, the Yorba Linda police had received calls about screaming somewhere in this embryonic development. Because the area had not yet been annexed into the city, the complaint fell into the jurisdiction of the sheriff's department. At the end of the street, the deputies saw a white pickup that belonged to the company that owned Bordeaux, Toulmin Brothers. It was parked in front of three almost completed display models.
"Looks like there's a foreman still here," Ken said.
"Or maybe it's the night watchman on duty a little early," Teal said.
They parked behind the truck, got out of the stiflingly hot patrol car, and stood for a moment listening. Silence. Ken shouted,
"Hello? Anybody here?"
His voice echoed back and forth through the deserted tract. Ken said,
"You want to look around?"
"Shit, no," Teal said. "But let's do it."
Ken still did not believe anything was wrong at Bordeaux Ridge. The pickup could have been left behind at the end of the day. After all, other equipment remained on the tract overnight, a couple of bobcats on a long bed truck, a backhoe, and it was still likely that the reported screaming had been kids playing. They grabbed flashlights from the car, because even if electric service to the tract had been connected, there were no lamps or ceiling lights in the unfinished structures. Resettling their gun belts on their hips, more out of habit than out of any belief that they would need weapons, Ken and Teal walked through the nearest of the partially framed houses. They were not looking for anything in particular, just going through the motions, which was half of all police work. A mild and inconstant breeze sprang up, the first of the day, and blew sawdust ghosts through the open sides of the house. The sun was falling rapidly westward, and the wall studs cast prison bar shadows across the floor. The last light of the day, which was changing from gold to muddy red, imparted a soft glow to the air like that around the open door of a furnace. The concrete pad was littered with nails that winked in the fiery light and clinked underfoot.
For $180,000, Teal said,
probing into black corners with the beam of his flashlight, I'd expect rooms a little bigger than these. Taking a deep breath of sawdust-scented air, Ken said,
Hell, I'd expect rooms as big as airport lounges.
They stepped out of the back of the house, into a shallow rear yard, where they switched off their flashes. The bare, dry earth was not landscaped. It was littered with the detritus of construction, scraps of lumber, chunks of broken concrete, rumpled pieces of tar paper, tangled loops of wire, more nails, useless lengths of PVC pipe, cedar shingles discarded by roofers, styrofoam soft drink cups and Big Mac containers, empty Coke cans, and less identifiable debris. No fences had yet been constructed, so they had a view of all 12 backyards along the street. Purple shadows seeped across the sandy soil, but they could see that all the yards were deserted.
No signs of mayhem, Teal said. No damsels in distress, Ken said. Well, let's at least walk along here, look between buildings, Teal said. We ought to give the public something for their money.
2 houses later, in the 30-foot-wide pass-through between structures, they found the dead man.
Damn, Teal said.
The guy was lying on his back, mostly in shadow, with only the lower half of his body revealed in the dirty red light, and at first Ken and Teal didn't realize what a horror they'd stumbled across. But when he knelt beside the corpse, Ken was shocked to see that the man's gut had been torn open.
Jesus Christ, his eyes, Teal said.
Ken looked up from the ravaged torso and saw empty sockets where the victim's eyes should have been. Retreating into the littered yard, Teal drew his revolver. Ken also backed away from the mutilated corpse and slipped his own gun out of his holster. Though he'd been perspiring all day, he suddenly felt damper, slick with a different kind of sweat, the cool, sour sweat of fear.
PCP, Ken thought. Only some asshole stoned on PCP would be violent enough to do something like this.
Bordeaux Ridge was silent. Nothing moved except the shadows, which seemed to grow longer by the second.
Some angel dust junkie did this, Ken said,
putting his fears about PCP into words.
I was thinking the same thing, Teal said. You want to look any farther? Not just the two of us, by God. Let's radio for assistance.
They began to retrace their steps, warily keeping a watch on all sides as they moved, and they did not go far before they heard the noises. A crash, a clatter of metal, glass breaking. Ken had no doubt whatsoever where the sounds came from. The racket originated inside the closest of the 3 houses that were nearing completion and that would serve as sales models. With no suspect in sight, and no clue as to where to begin looking for one, they would have been justified in returning to the patrol car and calling for assistance. But now that they'd heard the disturbance in the model home, their training and instinct required them to act more boldly. They moved toward the back of the house. A plyboard skin had been nailed over the studs, so the walls were not open to the elements, and chicken wire had been fixed to the tar-papered boards, and half the place was stuccoed. In fact, the stucco looked damp, as if the job had been started only today. Most of the windows were installed. Only a few cutouts were still covered with tattered sheets of opaque plastic. Another crash, louder than the first, was followed by the sound of more glass shattering inside. Ken Dimes tried the sliding glass door that connected the rear yard and the family room. It was not locked. From outside, Teal studied the family room through the glass. Although some light still entered the house by way of undraped doors and windows, shadows ruled the interior. They could see that the family room was deserted, so Teal eased through the half-open door with his flashlight in one hand, and his Smith & Wesson clutched firmly in the other.
You go around front, Teal whispered, so the bastard doesn't get out that way.
Bending down to stay below window level, Ken hurried around the corner, along the side of the house, around to the front, and every step of the way he half expected someone to jump on him from the roof or leap out through one of the unfinished windows. The interior had been sheetrocked, the ceilings textured. The family room opened into a breakfast area adjoining the kitchen, all of it one large flowing space without partitions. Oak cabinets had been installed in the kitchen, but the tile floor had not yet been put down. The air had the lime